Democrats are in South Florida for their debates. Will they tackle the issue of immigration? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Last night, WLRN Sundial and the Miami Herald hosted the first of two town halls. We tackled the issue of immigration ourselves. Topics range from the politics of controversial childhood detention facilities like the one in Homestead.
I go back to his base. What they want is deterrence. And they see the family separation situation as a valid form of deterrence.
And the impact that has on how we're seen from abroad.
How is this affecting the image of the United States? As a country that we've always insisted it was a country with a foreign policy based on principles and morality and all the rest.
For the next hour, you'll hear from a panel of reporters, professors, and advocates on many immigration issues recorded in front of a live audience. And you can watch a video of the event on our Facebook. All of that ahead on Sundial. First, the news.
Well, hello, hello, and welcome to this special broadcast from WLRN Sundial and the Miami Herald. I'm Luis Hernandez. I appreciate you being here today. This is the first of two town hall events leading up to the Democratic debates. Those debates, of course, are Wednesday and Thursday. Over the next couple of days, we're going to try to tackle some of the issues we hope they're going to discuss in those debates. And the two topics we decided on are immigration and climate risk. Now, tonight, solely, our conversation will be solely on immigration. Now, there's a lot to cover. Let me introduce the panel so we can jump right into the conversation. First up, starting from your left to the right, we have WLRN's America's editor, Tim Padgett. All right. We also have the Miami Herald's immigration and enterprise reporter, Monique Madden. The director of the Kimberly Green Latin American and Caribbean Center and professor in the Department of Politics and International Relations at FIU, Frank Mora. Also joining us, executive director of the Family Action Network Movement, Marlene Bastian. And the family program director for Americans for Immigrant Justice, Adonia Simpson. I want to jump in, and we're going to start with this topic. There were going to be ICE raids this past weekend. That was at least the threat. That obviously changed, but I wanted to just mention this real quickly because on Saturday, President Trump had tweeted out the following, quote, "At the request of Democrats, I have delayed the illegal immigration removal process for 2 weeks to see if the Democrats and Republicans can get together and work out a solution to the asylum and loophole problems at the southern border. If not, deportations start!" Exclamation point, end quote. Monique Madden, let me start with you because we talked to you on Friday. Again, the ICE raids were going to happen in numerous cities across the country. Miami was one of them. Since, though, the retraction, what are you hearing from communities in South Florida, in Miami specifically, leaders, mayors, law enforcement, what are they saying?
Well, some of them are saying that they have not been briefed by ICE. They're saying that, for example, the city of Miami's police chief has said that he thinks that criminals should be deported. So you have statements like that coming from the city. You have the county mayor saying that he hopes people are paying attention to the climate of immigration now during the elections. You have leaders telling people to seek advice from their attorneys. You have a mixed bag of emotions coming from not only leaders, but from people who are going through it.
And, I mean, there was a lot of talk about people going into hiding. And so now we're waiting possibly 2 weeks. We don't know what's going to happen. But, I mean, what are you getting a sense from the community? Are people still hiding?
Yes, they are. A lot of them don't actually believe that the raids have been canceled. They are hiding. Some of them have sold their stuff. I've talked to people who have sold their cars. They're very scared for their families. They're trying to figure out what's going to happen to their children if they're deported. Guardianship questions. What's going to happen to my kids? A lot of them believe that that was just an announcement from the president saying that they would be canceled to give law enforcement the upper hand in catching them by surprise.
Adonia Simpson, again, you know, you work with families. And so I'm wondering what you've been hearing, and what are you telling the community? What are you telling people right now?
First of all, as Monique mentioned, get a consultation with an attorney, an immigration attorney, not a notario. Talk to an attorney to see what options are available. Know your rights. I think there's a lot of misinformation. Immigrants do have rights. People have rights regardless of status under the Constitution. And we're reinforcing knowledge about that. And then ultimately, we want people to understand, to plan for the worst. It can happen, and we see too often in detention where it's too late, and they don't know what they're going to do with their kids, they don't know what they're going to do with their assets, so really encouraging people to have difficult conversations now.
Marley Bastien, you wanted to say something.
Yes, I wanted to say something. I do agree with Monique. People do not believe that the raids really stopped. We've been receiving a lot of calls at our center about what to do, should we put our kids with family members, should we sell our homes, should we send our kids to school, and things like that. I've also been reading a lot of misinformation on Facebook about people talking about these illegals, they deserve to be deported. I think we need to clarify that just because someone is has a final order of deportation doesn't mean that you are illegal, you're not supposed to be here. You can be placed on final order of deportation for any foreseeable reasons. For example, we know immigrants move all the time just by missing a court hearing because you missed a piece of mail can put you on a final order of deportation. So you don't need to be a criminal or illegal to be placed on final orders of deportation. People need to know that. And if you apply for political asylum, you're not an illegal, because by law, if you are leaving your country because of fear, such as people coming from Nicaragua, for example, Venezuela, Haiti, countries that are in turmoil right now, you have the right, the legal right to apply for political asylum, and the U.S. is obligated by law to afford you the basic rights of due process to apply.
Let's come back to this, though. Tim, the president makes a threat, then takes it back. We've seen this. You know, he said something about Mexico, threatened Mexico, took it back. Threatened Iran, took it back. He did just relaunch his campaign. Is this something we should take serious?
Well, I think we should take it serious in a rather cynical fashion. 2.5 years into this presidency, I've learned as a journalist to look at these kinds of actions through a fairly cynical lens. And what concerns me here is that, for example, you know, saying, well, now I'm backing off for a couple of weeks because I want to see if the Republicans and the Democrats can solve the asylum disaster that we have on the border. It takes a lot more than 2 weeks to solve a problem like our dysfunctional asylum infrastructure on the border. My rather cynical fear is that while it looks on the surface as though he's being benign in terms of, you know, giving these immigrants who have these final deportation orders a reprieve for 2 weeks, what I'm really fearing is that after those 2 weeks, Trump will say, "Well, look, I gave Congress the chance to fix this. They couldn't see." It can't be done, so I'm going to have to go ahead and do the punitive thing now, which is send all these people back.
Florida this year passed the law banning sanctuary cities in the state. This essentially requires local law enforcement to cooperate with ICE when it comes to detention requests. Now, the head of the Republican Party of Florida, Joe Gruters, who's also one of the key sponsors of the legislation, he spoke on the Florida Roundup. Let's take a listen to what he said about sanctuary cities.
This is about saving lives, protecting Americans, and making sure that people follow the law. We are a country of laws. This is not a new law. It just says basically let's follow the laws that are on the book and let's comply with the federal government.
Frank Morham, what you understand of the law, I mean, what does it mean for undocumented immigrants here in Miami in this situation?
So the question I have, and by the way, we're in new territory in many ways. I do believe that these raids will occur for two reasons. One, Tim explained it very well. I think in 2 weeks we're not going to solve this problem. But second, because his political base want this to happen. The question I have from an operational standpoint is, how is Miami going to look like if there are thousands and thousands of deportation orders, will ICE literally invade Miami? This requires thousands of ICE agents to come in and start taking people. Cubans that are under deportation orders, Cubans, only Cubans, or 37,000 Cubans that have deportation orders, are they going to do half of the other Cubans? How much are they going to do Nicaraguans? In other words, I don't see how, from an operational standpoint, this looks like. Because if they're going to literally begin deporting 37,000 Cubans, 67,000 Venezuelans, et cetera, that requires an invasion force. So how are they going to prioritize who and how they take or detain?
Monique Madden, what has law enforcement said about its role in this? And again, you know, with that amount of time, is it something that law enforcement is going to be working with ICE in trying to figure out how they would help in those raids? Would they help in the raids? Or is it just people who are already in detention helping in, you know, attaining those people? What's the role in law enforcement here?
Miami-Dade Police is saying that they are not assisting with ICE. They cannot confirm or deny whether or not they've been briefed. So we'll see about that.
Remind people, too, by the way, if ICE does take someone, where do they go? What's the process?
Sure. So they go to a detention facility, whether that is at Chrome or BTC, which is Broward Transitional Center up in Broward. In this case, particularly these raids, they're saying family detention centers. Where those are, we don't know. They're not saying where they would be taken. So there's a lot of confusion out there.
I think it's important to add that people may end up here locally at Chrome or BTC, but they could be sent anywhere across the country. If somebody has a final order of removal, their clock is ticking. They're subject to removal from the country fairly quickly. A lot of these individuals may have a valid basis to reopen their case and rescind the in absentia order, their order of removal, and pursue relief, but it's going to move very, very quickly.
Marlene Beshon.
And one thing that we tend to oversee when these decisions are being made, the state of Florida, for example, is to not take into consideration the children. These immigrants, they've been living here for many, many years. They have children in our elementary school, in middle school, in high school. You're gonna take all these parents into detention. Do you have the infrastructure to take care of these children?
Frank Mora, and Tim, you could jump in as well. I want to know, how do you compare what you're seeing now in this administration to the past two or three administrations? Let's not forget, under Obama, there were a lot of deportations.
Yes, that's true. But Obama was deporting criminals, right? Very specific. President Trump has just widened the aperture to deport anybody who was here undocumented, regardless of whether they committed a crime, regardless of whether they have children. I mean, there's no criterion by which you get detained and deported as long as you have. Or,
what about under President Bush? What did we see?
I think some of the same thing. So it's the scope and the scale that's different here, right? You are right to say that previous presidents have deported undocumented people. That is very true, and President Obama did this during a certain time quite a bit, but it was very focused on the issue of criminals. The president has changed the rules in many ways about how he's going to going about that, and the question that I'm concerned about is, even though, as Marlene says, there are still rights that these individuals have, my fear in an administration that is not prone to look and respect norms and the rule of law, that they will forget simply all the things you've just mentioned and just deport these people regardless.
Before we finish up this segment, real quickly, Tim, let me start with you, but I want to hear from anybody on the table. Is everything that's happening right now, is it getting to Latin American countries or any country where anybody's trying to get here? Do they see what we're doing? Do they know? And are they taking that journey and that chance anyway?
Oh, yes.
Knowing that their children could be taken from them.
Very, very much so. They see what's happening. What they don't understand often, and I've found this just doing
for example, television appearances on Spanish language TV shows where I'm talking with journalists from the region. What they don't seem to understand so much is why. And if I always find the one thing I'm having to explain to the Latin American audience is that Trump is doing this for his base, for his rather nativist, some might even say racist, base of voters who want to see immigrants and immigration punished. It was the thing that put President Trump over the top in the 2016 election, this demonization of immigrants.
Adonia Simpson, I'd like your take on that. What are you telling people right now, again, about what their rights are?
Well, first of all, as far as I think we need to address the push factors, there's all these things happening here, and absolutely, I think immigrants may not understand why things are happening here that to slow the flow of immigration, but as advocates and attorneys, we meet with people every day that are suffering such horrendous things, and there's push factors that are pushing them out of their countries, and they're fleeing their countries. So it makes one wonder how horrible things are for them to take that journey and come, despite what they may be hearing in the news.
We're going to stop right there again and just take a break here. When we come back, we're going to switch things up, and we're going to talk about the Homestead Child Detention Center. Again, more on WLRN's Facebook page. We're going to take more of your questions coming up next. Thanks. We'll be right back. Welcome back to our WLRN Sundial Miami Herald Town Hall. Tonight we are talking about the issue of immigration. This, of course, leading up to the Democratic debates that will be at the Arch Center on Wednesday and Thursday. We have a great crowd. Thank you so much for coming in tonight. You know, one of the things I wanted to point out for this segment, we're going to be talking about the Homestead Child Detention Facility. And there was actually a story that broke not too long ago. I just want to read this to you briefly because it fits with what we're talking about. This just published by the New York Times. I'm just reading it from their page. Following a public outcry, hundreds of migrant children have been transferred out of a filthy border patrol station in Texas where they were detained for weeks without access to soap, clean clothes, or adequate food. Some of the children were transferred into a shelter system maintained by the Department of Health and Human Services, others sent to a temporary tent facility in El Paso. So that's the latest story on that. I want to reintroduce the panel real quickly. I've got with me WLRN's America's editor, Tim Padgett, the Miami Herald's immigration and enterprise reporter, Monique Madden, director of the Kimberly Green Latin American and Caribbean Center, and also professor at FIU, Frank Mora, executive director of FAM, Marlene Bastian, and the family program director for Americans for Immigrant Justice, Adonia Simpson. We have some of our audience who have their own questions. If you could, just introduce yourself. Your first name is fine.
Sure.
And then ask your question.
And the name is Charles. I'm from Miami. So my question is, there are many immigrants who are now subject to deportation who were eligible to be citizens, and now they're being deported. Is there any effort to encourage people to make the move to secure their status so that, you know, they're not subject to being deported?
Absolutely. At Americans for Immigrant Justice, we do a lot of community legal screenings because you're absolutely right. Right now, with no change in law, there's about 16% of the undocumented population that may have a pathway to some sort of permanency, and it's critical that we identify those individuals and help them on that pathway to try to avoid any sort of removal.
All right. We have another question from our audience. Please step up.
Thank you for having us tonight. My name is Andrea. I'm from Miami. And my question is, with respect to SB 168 and increased collaboration with local law enforcement here in Florida and ICE, how do we as Floridians extinguish these systems of apprehension at the local, municipal, and statewide level?
And you're speaking specifically about the program where ICE can train, right? Is that the one you're talking about, where they can train
local law enforcement?
They can train local law enforcement to help them.
I think it's important to distinguish what SB 168 does. It's really to encourage law enforcement to do its best efforts to comply with detainer policies. Something else that we're seeing a huge movement of, as Andrea mentioned, was 287G programs, which are the programs that deputize law enforcement.
That's the one. Thank you.
To act as ICE an arm of ICE. We're also seeing a lot of increased action called warrant service officers, where law enforcement is able to actually go into facilities and serve as immigration as well. It's not as complete as the 287G agreements that require contracting and a process.
Yeah, I would also point out, as precedent, look at Arizona, because we weren't the first state really to try something like this. Arizona many years ago also thought, you know, that they could go down this path without any problems. Well, there were problems, and I think Florida's going to have to, if we start hitting these same problems as well, we're going to have to look back at Arizona and see how they dealt with it.
Thank you so much for the question. I appreciate it. As we jump into this conversation about the Homestead Detention Facility, we heard from Democratic Congresswoman Debbie Mercosal Powell on Friday. She represents District 26, and she told us about a recent visit that she had to the facility. Let's take a listen to what she had to say.
I don't understand how we are keeping close to 3,000 kids in a facility that is a prison. It's a light security prison. That is what I'm going to call it, because they have absolutely no freedom. They are living in a highly regimented schedule with a lot of security. They are sleeping in very crowded areas, 144 bunk beds with numbers next to the bunk beds. They are referred to by numbers, not by their names. They don't have enough representation. They don't have enough case managers working on their cases.
Again, that is Congresswoman Debbie Mercosal Powell. Monique Madden, there is a report now of another sexual assault at the facility. I think this is seven since August. But what's going on at the facility in this particular issue?
It's a dark abyss when it comes to numbers or statistics or any cases at all. The federal government won't release that. All we know is that sexual assault is investigated by the FBI. Those numbers are not public record. The only reason we even know about these sexual assaults is because they report them to the Department of Children and Families, and then they just have a record of it. But the DCF doesn't investigate them at all.
Remind us who runs the center, who runs this facility?
Sure. It's a private company called Comprehensive Health Services, Caliburn, and it's a for-profit company that has since opened up two more in Texas.
How long do those children stay at the center?
That's a really tricky answer, because on average it's more than 2 months, but that answer is really misleading, because we've talked to kids that have been, well, Congress has talked to kids that have been there more than 8 months. So getting the average is not the best number to represent how long these kids are actually staying in there.
Tim Padgett, how do you see this issue playing out, not just in the debates, but I think just in the election season for next year, images of children in this kind of facility, how do you see that being used, being played out throughout the election?
Well, I think President Trump has a very tricky balancing act to do here politically on this, because on the one hand, as bad as we consider these images and these reports of the conditions that these children are living in, again, I go back to his base. What they want is deterrence, and they see these situations, particularly the family separation situation, as a valid form of deterrence, a punishment, really, to keep immigrants away from the United States. And so on the one hand, he's got to galvanize his base for this upcoming election, and that's how he does it, by punishing immigrants. But on the other hand, he also has to realize that a majority of the people in this country do favor comprehensive immigration reform, and they are repelled by these images that we're hearing about. I don't know how he reconciles the two things, frankly.
Frank Mora, I'm wondering how Latin American countries view us right now as they see that. And again, this comes back to what I asked you before, Tim was saying, is that a deterrent?
No, it's a deterrent. In fact, the policies of family separation, kids separating, had been in effect for some time, and in fact, the numbers kept coming or increasing. But you raised, Lewis, an important question that's not often talked about, and that is not only what that does politically inside the United States, but how is this affecting the image of the United States as a country that we've always claimed and insisted it was a country with a foreign policy based on principles and morality and all the rest. And it's really changing. I travel in the region, Latin America,
quite a bit, and that people are just astounded to see that the United States is doing these kinds of things, right? And if you look at the Pew and other polling of what is, when asked of Latin Americans, a poll that they do of 16 countries in the region, our numbers have never been lower than they are today. There's a number of reasons for that. I don't want to say it's because of this issue, but I think this issue is having an impact because they're seeing, and this, the news in Latin America carry this all the time, this issue of parents being separated from their children. And the perception is that what the United States is doing is they're kidnapping these kids. That's the language, secuestro. That's the language that they're using in the region, because then they deport their parents and they stay with their children. That's kidnapping, and gets repeated over and over again. And you know who repeats that over and over again? Russia Today, the Chinese networks. They keep repeating that on cable news in Latin America, really hurting our image in the region.
Monique.
I want to jump in. You mentioned separation of parents and their kids. It's not just parents that are being separated. It's aunts, it's uncles, it's siblings that are being separated at the border. It's legal guardians that are being separated from their children. This is kind of like a loophole that's happened. Unaccompanied minors, those are the kids that are being held at the homestead facility. And the definition is any child under the age of 18 that has been separated from their biological parent. So if your mom and dad died, which a lot of the cases, a lot of these kids don't have parents. They're raised by their aunts or their uncles or their older sibling who happens to be 15 years older than them. They're separated from their family, not just their parents. So that's like a whole new dynamic. It's a whole new layer to family separation.
Marlene Bastian.
The only thing I'd like to add is that these children do not need to spend so much time in detention centers. Our agency used to assist in reuniting children with their parents or loved ones. You complete the psychosocial assessment, you do a home visit, which we used to do, and if you find that the home is appropriate and safe, you release the children. It does not need to take so long. If we claim that we are the champion of human rights, how come we, in good conscience, treat children like worse than animals in some cases? We, as a nation, we need to be the conscience of this government and then put pressure, because we're not doing enough. We need to do more. We ought to do more, because this is unacceptable.
We've heard from a lot of different people who've been to the center. They've been to different centers. One of them is Republican former Congressman Carlos Curbelo. He was on Sundial recently, and he talked about the Homestead Detention Center, but also one that he visited in Palmetto Bay. It was run by a Catholic organization. Let's take a listen.
I visited two facilities, one in Homestead and one in Palmetto Bay, which cares for very small children, so children under the age of 5. In the case of the Palmetto Bay shelter that's run by the Catholic Church, my wife and I visited, the children received a very high level of care. As a matter of fact, a group of them had just come back from the Seaquarium because they had been taken on a field trip to get to see Miami Seaquarium, which I was very impressed. I didn't know that that degree of detail and of attention was given to these children.
Adonia Simpson, would having a church or a nonprofit running the facility be better?
That's an interesting question. I think it's important to maybe step back a little bit to talk about how the process and the shelters work generally. When a child's detained at the border, they're initially in ICE and CBP custody, and then they're transferred to the custody of the Office of Refugee Resettlement. And they do contract out to organizations across the country. We provide legal services at various organizations here in South Florida. And there's a lot of smaller shelters that are very individualized and provide phenomenal services. There's also, Homestead is an emergency receptive center. It was created because there weren't enough smaller shelters to really house everybody. So that's, I think, an important distinction to make as to comparing Homestead to the other smaller shelters.
Do you think that people in other countries understand, they see this, they see what's happening in the news? And I wonder what you've heard from anyone who's been separated from their families about their stories and what it's been like for them.
Absolutely. It's been harrowing. We represent several families that were separated last summer, and hearing the anguish of their stories is very difficult. It was a very, you know, relationships still haven't mended. Children in a lot of ways still haven't forgiven their parents for being ripped away from them. I think another thing I wanted to jump back to that was discussed too about earlier was Marlene is absolutely right. There are many of the children that are coming are seeking to reunite with family that are here already in the United States, all across the country. But the procedures are in place to provide a level of protection. It wasn't so long ago that we heard stories of children being released from shelters and put in very unsafe situations or were trafficked. So it's a very difficult balance to find a level of protection to ensure that children are going to safe homes, but then also, as Marlene said, ensuring that they are quickly moving out. And we have heard reports that there are things being done to try to facilitate and make that process move much more quickly.
I know that we have one of our guests here in the audience who's been standing and waiting. I appreciate your patience. And you have a question for the panel. Please step up, tell us your first name, and ask away.
Well, thank you for having us. My name is Sam. I wrote here South Miami, but I think I'm Coral Gables now. But my question is, considering how important immigrants are to the South Florida economy, how do we as regular citizens help create pathways for undocumented immigrants to become citizens or at least come out of the shadows?
Go ahead, Marlene Bastien.
There has to be a political will to get that done. There are over 11 million undocumented in this country. They are not on charities. They don't qualify for charity. They are homeowners. They are employers. They are business owners. They contribute. They pay taxes because some countries like Mexico and Salvador, they give them identifications to they can open bank accounts, and they do pay taxes, and we know that. They contribute to our economy. I think it is smart for us, if we are concerned about national security, to pass a law, comprehensive immigration reform, so you know where these 11 million people are.
And real quickly, Tim.
Yes. She's addressing a more practical level here in immigration reform. I think one of the things South Floridians can do is lobby their Congress people and senators harder to fix broken systems, for example, like the HB2 visas. Many of our immigrants here are involved in agriculture, and that HB2 visa, which is designed to make a more sensible system for receiving and that kind of immigrant needs a lot of work.
So I'm going to stop there. We're going to take one more break. Coming up in the next segment, we're going to focus on temporary protected status, TPS, also Venezuela, Cuba. I'm going to try to crunch all that into one segment. It's a lot. And we'll continue this conversation here in just a moment. Thanks so much. Welcome back. Again, welcome to our WLRN Sundial Miami Herald Town Hall tonight. We're talking about immigration issues. It is a big topic. We're trying to cover a lot in a short time. Again, this is the lead up to the Democratic debates, which are on Wednesday and Thursday at the Arch Center. For this segment, I wanted to cover, we're going to try to talk about TPS, Venezuela, and Cuba, if we can, and we'll take a couple more audience questions here in a little bit. Again, just to remind you, we have up on our stage WLRN's America's editor, Tim Padgett, going from left to right, the Miami Herald's immigration and enterprise reporter, Monique Madden, director of the Kimberly Green Latin American and Caribbean Center, Mr. Frank Mora, executive director of FAM, Marlene Bastien, and family program director for the Americans for Immigrant Justice, Adonia Simpson. Marlene Bastien, if I may start with you real quickly, we talk about TPS, the Trump administration ending TPS for Haitians, Hondurans, Nicaraguans, many other groups. A court did come back and say that ending TPS is not proper at this time, but this is an ongoing battle. You've been on Sundial before. We've talked about this issue, and I'm just wondering right now, Haitians you've spoken to and families you've spoken to, there's a deadline. How are people feeling at this moment? How are they preparing for whatever that future may be?
very anxious. We have a lot of family members calling our center every day wondering what to do, especially they understand that there was a lawsuit. We were part of the lawsuit, and we won the lawsuit against President Trump, and as a result, they don't have to be deported. Haitians, for example, do not have to be deported July 22nd, 2019. However, they are, by January 2020, Haiti, El Salvador, Honduras, Nicaragua, even earlier, January, yes, 2020, they are facing deportation. The people are anxious. They are suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome. We have a lot of our members calling us about being identified with chronic illnesses, such as high blood pressure. It is creating a lot of problems for our members. So that is why we were very happy when the DREAM Act passed the House recently, but people are still anxious because they want to know in a few months, January, it's not a long time, what are they going to do?
Tim Padgett, there's also been word of Venezuelans getting TPS. Where is that right now?
Vice President Pence was here last week, and he was asked the same question out of Port Miami, and he said, we are considering it, which is what President Trump himself said a few weeks ago. The problem, though, is how does an administration that has essentially said TPS is bad and we want to end it, then all of a sudden turn around and say, but you know, we really want to develop the Venezuelan vote here. And so we think maybe since things aren't going so well in our campaign to get rid of the dictatorship in Venezuela, as we promised them it would by now, one of the things we can offer them is TPS. That's all well and good, but it really doesn't jive with what they're doing with all of the other. How can you say to Venezuelans, we're going to give you TPS, but you know what, we're ending it for every other national group in the country? I just don't think they're going to be able to justify that.
I want to come back to a conversation that we had recently with former Republican Congressman Carlos Garbello on this issue. Let's take a listen.
Something else that I advocated for over the years, that Venezuelans are granted temporary protected status. They clearly need it. They clearly cannot return to Venezuela. 4 million people have, Venezuela has produced 4 million refugees. We can't expect that people will return. And there are many Venezuelans living illegally in our country, and they should be afforded an opportunity to get right with the law and probably to stay here, because I don't think anyone's going to be returning to Venezuela for a very long time.
Frank Moore, is there bipartisan congressional support?
Something else
for this
that I advocated for over
there is bipartisan, yeah, support. There is legislation in the Senate, I believe in the House, that both in the Senate side, Senator Menendez and Senator Rubio have supported providing TPS, among other things, and the Venezuelan issue, TPS to Venezuelans, and the similar legislation in the Congress. The question then is whether Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, will allow that to move forward, knowing and understanding that with his political base, as well as the president's political base, it would be very difficult to sell TPS to Venezuelans when you have a policy so restrictive as the president has. So there is bipartisan support. There is bipartisan support, by the way, on the issue of Venezuela.
He's talked about TPS for Venezuelans because of what's going on in that country. But we're saying to Haitians, Nicaraguans, Salvadorans, you have to go back. Your country's fine. Why the push for Venezuela TPS and say to everybody else, that's it?
Well, one should not be surprised by the inconsistencies and the incongruences of this administration. But I think it would be very extremely transparent, as Tim said, for the administration to make an exception only for the Venezuelans, right? And then others to the right of Mitch McConnell will say, well, I thought you were about this. And I think, if anything, the president will do everything as long as it is not to alienate anyone on his political base.
Donia Simpson, how many Venezuelan families are you seeing lately?
We're seeing hundreds at our clinics, and many of these individuals are seeking asylum. I don't know if you're aware, but there was recently a change in the way asylum is being processed at our local asylum offices. Previously, they had priority categories of individuals that were lined up first to have their interview. Now they've switched to something called last in, first out, which means generally if you apply for asylum today, you may get an interview in 30 days. which is difficult because people may not have sufficient evidence, their applications may not have been completed well, they may not fully understand how to apply for asylum. If you go forward with the asylum interview and you're not granted asylum, you're then referred to the immigration court, which is just adding to our immigration court backlog that we've been seeing. But we've been seeing many, many Venezuelan asylum seekers at all of our clinics.
Venezuelans are the largest group of asylum applicants right now in the United States as well.
I wanted to jump to, and again, because there's a lot of topics I want to cover in this last segment, we got this question on Facebook. This from Matilda in Key Biscayne asking, why don't Peter Pan adults identify with the unaccompanied children? The Peter Pan adults, of course, the group of Cubans who came to this country as children, unaccompanied. So the question again is, why don't Peter Pan adults identify with these unaccompanied children? Does anybody want to respond to that? Oh, she got you. Matilda got you. Marlene Bestchen, go ahead.
No?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, we are expecting more support for these children. Why aren't we open arms about it? Why are we allowing the Trump administration to treat families seeking asylum at the border, which is something that they can do legally, and then the U.S. is obligated to afford them the right of due process? Why are we letting that happen? That's a good question.
I wanted to go to our audience because we do have some audience questions. I want to come over here to this gentleman who's been standing there patiently. Go ahead and introduce yourself. Step up to the microphone, though. Get close. It's okay.
Good evening, and thank you for your collective expertise. I'll try to keep up with Matilda here. I'm Mark, and I live in Coconut Grove. I'm the son of a mother who came from Iraq during World War II and was the beneficiary of better policies back then. My question is, what do you think are some the key myths or partisan half-truths which have stymied the process of forming long-term immigration reform? And then as a sub-question, do you think the natural emphasis on the large migration coming from Central America has detracted from the focus on the Middle Eastern diaspora, specifically Syria, Yemen, and Afghanistan to a lesser extent? Thank you.
All right, a couple of questions on this one, but myths and half-truths that might be impacting the way we deal with and look at immigration policy. Tim, let me start with you.
The interesting part of his question was the second part, I think. You know, is Central America detracting from our focus on other refugee groups? I think what you hit on really is the fact that we've got to be considering Central American, at least those Central American migrants from the Northern Triangle, El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. We have to be considering them in that same category as refugees, which we haven't been doing really. And for example, just recently we have noticed that a few months ago, we saw from the Customs and Border Patrol figures that Guatemalans suddenly were the largest number of Central American migrants, which is usually not the case. It's usually Salvadorans and Hondurans. Why were Guatemalans suddenly the largest number? Well, made a call to the Guatemalan Maya Center in Lake Worth, and Father Frank told me, well, it's because they're climate change refugees now. They can't grow food in Guatemala. And so suddenly we had, you know, apart from poverty and gang violence, we now have climate change refugees from Central America. So you're right. We're having to look at Central Americans now as refugees in the same way that we're looking at Syrians.
Frank Mora.
Yeah, so this is an important question because the language we use to address this question is critically important. If you dehumanize the immigrant, if you think that they're all rapists and gang members and that they're invading and that they're going to rape your daughter and so forth, then that other is the enemy. You're dehumanizing this person. So it is okay, therefore, to treat them the way we are treating them. And then how do you have a political debate about addressing a very complex problem when you're talking in those terms? So that's the first thing. The second thing is facts. You know, President Trump campaigned on that there was a crisis at the border. It is important that empirically there was no crisis at the border other than maybe the way that the immigration courts were dealing with it. They were caught. But there was no invasion. The numbers had been going down. undocumented migrants don't commit more crimes than documented or citizens. So it, to me, it seems that fighting the half-truth constantly with facts, I feel like we're always behind the curve. And I'm not sure how we get in front of it when people have already established in their minds that these immigrants are criminals, rapists, et cetera.
Thank you for that question. I appreciate it. We got another question from our audience. Sir, step up. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
My name's Paul from the unincorporated and here in the county. Continuing on with one of these myths, which is that the immigrants are taking away jobs from our citizens and our green card holders, which is one of the myths. The demand for undocumented adults in specific kinds of work. We know by default about farm labor and construction. Just talking about the state of Florida for now, or even our own metropolitan area, what are the other fields in our own area that we know well where a demand does exist and can be filled by?
Monique, go ahead.
I think the hotel industry is a huge one. I think even the private house cleaning business is a huge one. As far as the advocates that I've spoken to, do you want to jump in? Does anybody?
The New American Economy actually put out a great study as far as immigrant economic contributions, as well as where there was the greatest need labor-wise. But absolutely, I think the top categories were agriculture, hospitality, and nursing and home health. I know that when the announcement about temporary protected status was made, we actually were asked by a hospital in Southwest Florida to come out and do a Know Your Rights and legal screening because they had so many staff members that were going to be potentially impacted by this.
As the candidates are here, they're obviously trying to convince the voters that they are the choice to take on the president in 2020. This is the first of many, but this is a nationally televised event, so they're going to get their chance to try to sell themselves. What do you think the focus for these candidates should be? As they're even though they're talking to a national audience, they're talking to a South Florida audience. They're here in Miami. As they're here, what should their focus be? Maybe even what you would tell the candidates on how they should treat the trip here. Adonia Simpson, please.
I think the one issue that's important to me that I think doesn't receive enough attention that I wish it would was that we need an independent immigration court system. Right now, the immigration courts are within the Department of Justice, the Executive Office of Immigration Review, and they're subject to decisions by the Attorney General, which can turn asylum on its ear. They're subject to quotas. There's pressure for these family unit cases to be moved along extremely rapidly. There's no right to court-appointed counsel. So we're seeing thousands and thousands of people going unrepresented before our immigration judges that may have valid claims of relief under our current law and the ability to stay here lawfully that may not be able to get that.
Marlene Bastian, if you're talking to the candidates, what are you telling them?
Ask them to address the situation of the children, incarcerated children who are separated from their family members. This is a crisis. It needs to be solved. We want both Republicans and Democrats to put their heads together and solve it, and it needs to be done. So I have so much more to say to the candidates, but enough is enough.
Frank Morrow, briefly, real quickly.
I think that the one issue, this will have a national audience, but as you know, it's going to be aired in Telemundo, so it'll be a Spanish audience. We are in Miami, and the issues of inequality are going to be paramount. As you know, Bloomberg has reported that Miami is the most unequal city in the United States. The income gaps and wealth are significant here, and I imagine that for a Miami audience, they will want to hear more about that.
Monique, let me start with you. If the candidates came to you and said, what do you think is the most important thing that I should be talking about on this issue, what would you tell them?
Transparency. I think it's a huge one. I've been reporting on the Homestead Shelter as well as the other two shelters in South Florida, and we can't get a single thing out of the federal government. And you're pulling teeth. For example, there are three presidential candidates that are passing by the Homestead Shelter. One of them passed by today, two later on this week. And I think that they should be going inside the shelter, not just passing by and doing a press conference outside. I think that they need to push in the sense of going inside and getting us answers, because there are you've asked me so many questions, and my answer to you has been, we don't know. And I think that transparency needs to be tweaked.
Tim Padgett.
I think going back to Frank's point, I think if I were to tell any of these candidates the most important thing they need to emphasize, at least on the immigration issue, is to recalibrate the American mentality with regards to immigrants and immigration, to remind this country, get through to them again, that we are a country of immigrants.
Well, unfortunately, we've run out of time. I do want to mention real quickly that, as a note, we did invite Republican state lawmakers to join us for this conversation, and all the invitees were either unavailable or they respectably declined. We always invite a bipartisan conversation. Let me thank my panelists here again, WLRN's America's editor, Tim Padgett, the Miami Herald's immigration and enterprise reporter, Monique Madden, director of the Kimberly Green Latin American and Caribbean Center, and professor in the Department of Politics and International Relations at Florida International University, Frank Mora, executive director of Family Action Network Movement, Marlene Bastien, and family program director for Americans for Immigrant Justice, Adonia Simpson. Give them a hand, please. Thank you, of course, to my producers, Chris Remington and Alejandra Martinez, the WLRN television crew for today's Facebook Live, directed by Doug Clark. Chris DeAngelis has been running the board for sound. Thank you, Chris. And, of course, a big applaud for all of you. Thank you so much for coming out tonight. Thank you for your support. I really appreciate it.